Welcome to Parents' Perspective. The kindergarten parent-teacher evening was nearly over when the school principal opened the session to questions from the audience. John's hand went up immediately.
"Now, don't get me wrong," he began, clearing his throat. "Timmy loves to come to school each day, but, well, all he seems to do here is just play. Isn't he supposed to learn something?"
Before the teacher, Mrs. Collins, could take the microphone to reply, another parent rose to speak.
"My name is Kathleen Banks. I'm Eleanor's mother. All Eleanor seems to have done this year is finger paint and play in the dress-up corner. Does this mean I'm raising an artist or a fashion model? Isn't she supposed to be learning to read by now?"
Some of the other parents nodded their heads. Celia, a former kindergarten teacher, squirmed uncomfortably in her seat. She whispered to her husband, Dave,
"See what I mean? Things have really changed."
From a parent's perspective, what is the place of play in our children's lives, and how should we be contributing? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest can address for us the whole issue of play in our children's lives. Barbara Strom-Thompson is a child development specialist in private practice. She's a play advocate who works with teachers and parents regarding how play fosters optimal development. She designed a friendship camp based on how kids used to play in neighborhoods in past generations. Barbara has a 16-year-old daughter. Welcome to Parents' Perspective,
Thank
Barbara.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
A wise observer once noted that the work of childhood is play. Why is play so important?
Well, we could spend the entire hour just answering that question because play is so complex, and sometimes that's hard to see because it actually unfolds so beautifully in normally developing children. As a play advocate, when I speak about play, I always think about a little four-year-old who taught me something very important. I was sitting down on the floor with her, and she was playing, and I wasn't intervening in her play. She was definitely the director of the play, and I was enriching the play, but wasn't really saying that much. So I was pretty surprised when she said to me, "I can tell you things I can't tell my daddy." Because I knew her father. I had done some work with him. He was a very involved father, a good communicator. We had worked on all that. So I said to her, "Well, why is that?" And she said, "Because he doesn't play with me the way you do." Mm. And that had so much resonance that that was 12 years ago. And I have thought about that so often. She really taught me something important. My favorite play researcher, Brian Sutton Smith, says that children feel about play the way adults feel about the First Amendment. And I love that analogy because when you called me and asked if I'd be interested in this program, if you had said, "Well, you know, we really want you to come, Barb, but please don't talk about computers and don't talk about organized sports because we know how important that is to a lot of parents. And let's not talk about violence because that's really a downer right now." If I were censored, you really wouldn't know about my values and I wouldn't be able to fully express myself on this topic. And it's the same with children. If we don't respect their play, if we don't cherish it in the same way that adults cherish the First Amendment, our right to fully express ourselves, it protects our right for free speech. And so it's very important to adults and we hold it very dear in this country. And as a parallel, children feel the same way about their play because that's how they fully express themselves. Since this is a parenting program, I think it's really important to stress that free play and supporting that is an incredibly powerful parenting tool. When I teach my 8-week courses, no one comes to me because they want to know about play. They come to the courses because they have discipline issues. And in the first week, I give homework, really based on Stanley Greenspan's work. He's a preeminent child psychiatrist, and he did a lot of work on floor time, really teaching parents to be more intentional in fostering play. And so the ideal is that the parent would spend one-on-one time for about a half an hour a day. I know that's a lot, so I say even if you can fit in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, it's still fruitful, but it's uninterrupted. For instance, if I were in the playroom and I knew my child needed some help on fine motor control, or I might be so tired of playing, you know, the fort with the sofa cushions or something, I'm worn out. So other times I might say, "Well, let's go do a puzzle." or let's play Candyland because I won't have to focus, or it's not, you know, I don't want to mess up the dining room. But in the floor play, that is where the child gets the choice. And that's important. This is a little digression, but I remember once when my daughter was about 10, and she asked me to play ping pong, so we're playing ping pong. And then I said, well, you know, I have to go up and I have to make some calls. And she said, oh, but Mommy, when do I get my floor time? When do I? It's that element of choice that's so important. Yes. It's like if you get a gift certificate, for instance. I mean, you know, you get a $20 gift certificate, and it might be that you could have afforded to spend that $20, you know, out of your wallet. But it's that luxury of choosing that makes you feel just special. And so that's the difference in that during the floor time, I'm not going to intervene and say, now we need to work on this. It's the element of it's the child's agenda.
And you're not going to take telephone calls, and no one's going to come see you or open mail or anything like that.
So what I find in my parenting courses is when parents do that homework, I've had parents come the second week and say, oh, my gosh, I don't need this class now. Because they've gone from maybe 20 temper tantrums a day down to 4 or 5 a week. And they're much better able to address those in a calm and an effective way. So that it is a very powerful parenting key. Because, and this is really an overarching parenting perspective of mine, is that at the end of every day and at the end of our lives as parents, what children really want to know is that we enjoy them.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
I work with
wonderful quote.
I work with highly motivated parents, and they're very inspiring, and they're working so hard. But a lot of times they're working hard and not smart, because they're letting a lot of things crowd out the play. And, you know, as parents, it's important to pay the mortgage. It's really important to have the child get the immunizations and get the right shoe size and choose the right school and work at the PTA. But if we're not allowing time for play, children don't really understand that they're being well cared for. So that sense of enjoying your child is something. The good news is it's fun. It's a lot more fun than taking a child to get the immunizations. And the other news is that it helps us as parents because, again, play is such a wonderful lubricant. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful way to see what is important to our children, to really speak from the child's perspective. We know that playful play supports every aspect of optimal child development. We trivialize it. Your vignette was not exaggerated. I used to do child care licensing, and I would go into hundreds of nursery schools and daycare centers, and I would meet with directors. And one of my jobs was to ask directors about what kind of interviews and what kind of information they give to parents. And I heard so many complaints from directors because they would say, well, the parents don't want their children to play. And that's such a shame, because if you think about it, everything we want the child to develop can be supported through play.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of the importance of play.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with child development specialist Barbara Strom Thompson about the importance of play in our children's lives. When we were children, we just opened the back door and march out into the neighborhood and play with the kids. How has this picture changed over the years?
Well, it's changed dramatically. Mm. Society has changed so much in the last 25 years in terms of who's home in the neighborhood during the day. And play culture is very fragile. And if you think about play and recreation, it's characterized by spontaneity, by lack of sanctions and novelty. And so it changes very quickly, but it makes the play culture very fragile. So if anthropologists, say, would be looking at how two cultures come together, and they'd want to know what are the ramifications of that cross-cultural interaction, the first place they would look for change is in the play culture. rather than looking at education or government or business, because those are more intractable arenas. But the play changes very, very quickly. So a lot of times when I'm working with parents and there'll be problems, I'm looking at, you know, is it the school? Is it the child? Is it the parent? But there are also cultural aspects that go into how we're able to meet our child's developmental needs. I have an only child, and I know how important neighborhood play is for her when she was younger, and I would arrange my work schedule to be home in the afternoon. But there was no one else home in the afternoon.
Oh,
and so I had to really address that cultural issue, the way our neighborhoods have changed, so that she could meet her developmental needs. And there are lots of things that the parents can do.
What kinds of things did you do in that case?
Well, in her instance, well, actually, that was one of the catalysts for me to start a friendship camp, which was to really replicate neighborhood play. And I've presented to professionals, and I've talked with a lot of parents. You don't have to go start your own camp, but you can also look at the programming choices that you're making for your child, whether it's an after-school program or a camp choice, with a different eye. One of the reasons that there isn't as much independence in neighborhood play now is because of so many safety concerns and crime and violence. Even in neighborhoods where there is not the problem statistically of violence and crime, there's the fear of that and the perception that it's not safe. So I've worked with parents in a variety of ways. I've worked with parents who really understand the difference between free play and adult-directed play. I mean, parents are paying a lot of money to have their children going to a soccer practice, they're going to a puzzle-making class, and they're doing it often for supervised play. And yet what the child is getting is adult-directed play.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the difference. Between those.
Okay. Yeah. So because if you think of more structured programs, I'm not saying that there isn't value in those programs, but we want to have a balance so that there's some structure, but then there's ample opportunity, especially for very young children in the first 5 years of life, that there's ample opportunity for free and voluntary play. And the interesting thing about this is there's no one definition for play.
Mm-hmm.
We could probably fill a whole library with attempts to define play, because it's a little bit like art and religion and music. It's both corporate. It's different in different countries and different places. It has to do with the group, but it's also highly individual.
Mm.
And I think it really elevates, it takes away that a trivial notion of play and elevates it to its deserved important status with art and music and religion. So Aristotle tried to define play, and we don't have one definition of free and voluntary play, but there are some attributes that I think are helpful. So let's just say I were sitting down with some Play-Doh with the child. Now, I had three children there, and if I had all the children, they had to make the Play-Doh into a snake shape, and then we had to coil it into a pot. And if they wanted to pound it, I said, no, they had to do it my way. That wouldn't be play in the way that I'm advocating for. That's really a craft, because
it's an exercise.
It's an exercise, and it's not intrinsically motivated.
Yeah.
So one of the most important attributes of free and voluntary play is that it's intrinsically motivated. So it comes from the child's intrinsic need.
So in other words, to contrast that with what play would be, is if you gave the children the clay and said, see what you can make.
Right.
And that's
right.
It. Those were the directions.
That's right.
Just
boom,
enjoy
right.
Done.
And what happens is they might not make anything according to the adult's perception. And that's another attribute, is that free and voluntary play in early childhood is really focused on the process rather than the end product. And you'll see it all the time. Parents often will, if you're watching a child paint at the easel, you'll think, oh my gosh, what a beautiful painting. I'm going to frame that one. And the child keeps going and going and going, and pretty soon there are holes in the paper because it's dripping wet. The child is not as interested in the end product as interested in the process, and which is really important because if you look at what we're trying to accomplish with children, we want them to extend their attention span. So that part is very important. It's very different than following directions, the mm-hmm. intrinsic motivation.
It's interesting. Someone once said, and I can't remember if it was Dewey or somebody, said that our basic educational system came from the whole business of the Industrial Revolution with factories, and there's a product. You do this step, you do this step, and there's a product. And so it seems like that has carried over, because even today you see children bringing home their things that they've done from preschool.
Right.
And there it is, and isn't this nice, and we'll put it on the kitchen windowsill, and there's what you did, and there's your product.
And it's just like the one that little Johnny brought home next door.
Right. And that's an important point, because with play, and really very sophisticated play, very young children can be very, very involved in play. And one of the things that it does is that they make something unique.
Mm-hmm.
So that sometimes you go into a, let's say you go into back to school night and you see all these orange pumpkins and there's the purple one. Mm-hmm. And you go, I know that
that's my child.
And what that's important, because a lot of times when children are younger, parents are saying, well, why did you make a purple pumpkin? Why wasn't your pumpkin orange? So in the young years, we're tempted to encourage children to be like everyone else. And then suddenly they're teenagers, and we want them to stand on your own, don't be like everyone else, don't go along with the group. What play does is it gives you a wonderful opportunity to teach the child, it's good to be different. I mean, you can pay attention to that and to say, wow, I knew that was yours. Or I knew yours was the pumpkin with the tulip coming out of it. So if you're looking for fostering creativity, if you're looking for problem solvers, if you're looking at encouraging confident children who are sharing their own unique perspective, play is the arena, that the free play is where you want to focus.
Barbara, what do you think parents can do to provide greater free play time for our kids now that we know this is important stuff?
There's so many easy ways that they can foster play in the home and in the neighborhood. First of all, just providing a place where children can play. Children love little private places, and so you can get a refrigerator box and make room for that out on the deck for a while or in the backyard. Letting children know that you respect play by letting their play stand. So there might be a place in your home, if it's a table, if you have little toddlers around and your five-year-old is working on a Lego structure, that they don't have to clean it up every day, that there can be a sign that says, hands off, Molly's at work, so that the child can keep coming back again and again to the play. I've also had parents really come together with other like-minded parents who realized that this was so important, and so they would have really supervised block time. They would each take an afternoon, and the parent would be the presence supervising the play.
So now, what do you mean by supervising? That's
supervising,
a little bit of a
depending on
word.
The age. So that if there were three or four children, it's important to look at mixed age groups. So fostering that mixed age groups, so that it's not all the five-year-olds are playing together.
And
it can be different ages.
Is it better to have mixed age groups?
Well, it's really important, because children, if they show up at a playground, a four-year-old doesn't go up to someone who looks interesting and say, are you four? Children benefit by playing with older children, and they also benefit by playing with younger children. So when I work with children who have trouble making friends, I often ask the parents to foster regular play dates with a group of mixed ages. They don't have to be the same age. So that's another thing that they can do to replicate.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of the importance of play.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with child development specialist Barbara Strom Thompson about the importance of play in our children's lives.
Why is it that children benefit from the variety of ages?
Well, if you look at the benefits of socialization and play, what a child learns is, what does it mean to belong to a group? How do I do that? How do I get attention? And how do I show competence in the group? Sometimes you need to be a leader, and sometimes you need to be a follower. And good, highly competent players know how to do both. And so they learn that when they're the oldest, they learn how to nurture and take care and to be good teachers. And when they're the youngest, they learn to be followers also. And the give and take, really, in terms of the neighborhood play, you used to go out and you might get in a fight, you might have problems, but the next day you had to show up with the same children. So it was a necessity to get along, to be a problem solver, and to be creative and come up with new solutions. And so with regularly scheduled playdates, rather than going around to a different child each week, I mean, a lot of times what I find is that parents and caregivers will search for kind of an easy playdate. Oh, the child fought, and so this might not be a good playmate for my child. That's not true. Oftentimes parents will say, oh, my child loves this little boy. All they do is fight. But they challenge. And I think that's one of the things that I want to stress is free and voluntary play has an uncanny ability to give children what they need at that time in their development.
And so when you're talking about parents supervising, it doesn't necessarily mean parents problem solving in the interpersonal relationships.
That's right.
It means being there to be sure that there's no blood and that
they're safe.
Safe.
Okay. And even the way parents plan birthday parties. I mean, birthday parties are a big production all across this country. A lot of time at birthday parties is pretty passive. Children are watching. They're spectators. Children enjoy themselves a lot more often if they're smaller and they're simpler and there's a chunk of time for them to enjoy each other with raining pools and sprinklers in the backyard. Mm-hmm. So examining the way you entertain, the way you take vacations, even if you're going on a big tour, which a lot of times children don't like to drive from place to place, be sure you have some downtime, some hangout time every day so that the child can play. And you might look for vacation places where it could be a couple families, just say for a weekend, with the supervision, and it's a safe place. They could roam and go out and have a little bit of independence that they can't get at home, depending on the neighborhood. So a lot of good choices. I had a mom who was looking for a camp for her daughter and realizing that she couldn't find anything that really offered a lot of free play. So instead of paying for an expensive day camp, she hired a kindergarten teacher who was willing to work for her for a couple weeks. And for the same amount of money that she would have been paying for the day camp, she had four or five children, and they had a backyard camp. And the children put on their own play, and they had neighborhood play. So I think the key is for parents is not to confuse supervision with adult directed.
Mm-hmm. That's a big one. What happens as a child matures? What takes the place of play? Or does something take the place of play?
Well, the purpose of the play and recreation is the same in terms of it really does support the child's development in so many ways, physically, emotionally, but it looks very different. So that we know in the early years where motor development is driving cognitive development so much that the toddler is, you know, walking up and down the steps of the toddler slide again and again and again. Repetition is the name of the game there. Until they master that, and then that interest kind of goes away. And as you get older and children are playing in the housekeeping area at nursery school and you see a lot of children, you know, bossing each other around or negotiating and playing, it's they're really experimenting with adult roles, and they're really using that play to gain understanding of what it means to go out in the world. You get into first grade then, you know, after kindergarten, when the child's view starts turning outward, you get a lot more negotiating in terms of the social hierarchy in a class. And a lot of the kiss and chase games then that characterize fifth grade, for instance, those are very important too in terms of some of the budding interest in the opposite sex. And it starts with in the way they play tag.
It was so cute. I remember, I think it must have been, I don't know what grade in elementary school it was. One of my kids was telling my husband, oh, they were talking about play or something, what they were doing, and they were saying, oh, yes, well, we try to catch the girls. And so my husband said, well, what do you do when you catch them? And my son said, I don't know, we never caught one yet.
The play culture reflects our culture so much. I mean, play is both projective. We teach through it in what we allow children to do, but it also reflects. I spoke about play being a mirror for what's going on with our children. And when our country was going through the Monica Lewinsky and the Clinton scandal, those kiss and chase games became Monica and Bill games very quickly, even though
wow.
the children weren't, you know, it was very early and they didn't quite know what was going on. But it shows how fragile the play culture is and how responsive it is.
What resources would you suggest for listeners who want to learn more about the importance of play in our children's lives?
Well, I would recommend the National Association for the Education of Young Children. And it is a professional organization for early childhood educators with a special emphasis on parents. So they also provide information to parents. And they have a website, www.naeyc.org.
Can you say that one more time?
Yes. It's www.naeyc.org. They can also be reached at 1-800-424-2480. And they have a lot of resources on play. I hear from a lot of parents asking questions about violent play with children. And so one book that I recommend in terms of, you know, war toys and children's interest in kind of the superhero play, et cetera, which can get very problematic for certain children, is a book called Who's Calling the Shots? And it's by Nancy Carlson Page, and that's P-A-I-G-E, and Diane Levin. And that's by New Society Publishers.
We so much appreciate all of your recommendations, all of your help, and all the information you've given us today, Barbara Strom-Thompson. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 182. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Parents as Mentors in Washington, D.C. with Kids, our books, are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, you can visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.